Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, we discuss a promising step toward a functional cure for chronic hepatitis B, first-line pulsed field ablation for persistent atrial fibrillation, reducing the demand for transfusion in surgery, treatment for rifampicin-resistant tuberculosis, and a decade-long look at CAR T-cell therapy outcomes. We review peanut allergy and discuss a case of a man with leg weakness, pain, and weight loss. Perspectives explore GLP-1 access, air quality policy, and the human realities of homelessness. Phase 3 results of bepirovirsen treatment for chronic hepatitis B virus infection by Jinlin Ho from the Nanfang Hospital, Guangzhou, China, and co-authors. Chronic hepatitis B virus, HBV infection, is a serious global health concern affecting 240 million people worldwide and causing over a million deaths annually. This trial evaluated whether treatment with bepirovirsen, an antisense oligonucleotide targeting HBV transcripts, has the potential to result in a functional cure, defined by at least 24 weeks of a sustained HBV DNA level below the lower limit of quantification and hepatitis B surface antigen loss after fixed duration therapy. In two trials, more than 1,800 adults with non-cirrhotic chronic HBV infection were randomly assigned in a 2-to-1 ratio to receive subcutaneous bepirovirsen or placebo for 24 weeks. Significantly more patients who were assigned to receive 24 weeks of bepirovirsen and then stopped all anti-HBV treatment had a functional cure compared to those assigned to receive placebo. In a pooled analysis at 72 weeks, serious adverse events were reported in 7% of those in the bepirovirsen group and in 4% of those in the placebo group. Anna Locke from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, writes in an editorial that the trials by WHO and co-authors represent a major step toward a functional cure for HBV infection and notes that bepirovirsen is an attractive option for selected patients. While the overall results are impressive, they cannot be generalized to patient groups that were not included in the trials. Those with cirrhosis, co-infection with HIV, or a hepatitis B surface antigen level of more than 3,000 international units per milliliter. The durability of hepatitis B surface antigen loss has to be confirmed with longer follow-up, and alternative therapies are needed for other patients, such as those with cirrhosis or a baseline hepatitis B surface antigen level above 3,000 international units per milliliter. Ultimately, curative therapies must be simple, safe, accessible, and affordable to benefit the 240 million persons worldwide who are living with chronic HBV infection. Pulsed field ablation as initial therapy for persistent atrial fibrillation by Usama Wazni from the Cleveland Clinic, Ohio, and co-authors. Persistent atrial fibrillation is defined as a continuous atrial fibrillation episode lasting more than 7 days. It affects up to 50% of patients with atrial fibrillation. It is associated with a greater tendency toward adverse outcomes, including premature death, thromboembolism, heart failure, and increased frequency of healthcare use than paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. Catheter ablation has been shown to be superior to antiarrhythmic drug therapy in maintaining sinus rhythm, improving quality of life, and reducing healthcare use in patients in whom drug therapies have already failed. However, patients with persistent atrial fibrillation often have substantial electrical and structural remodeling, which leads to worse procedural outcomes with thermal-based ablation techniques than in patients with paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. In this trial, 310 patients with previously untreated persistent atrial fibrillation were randomly assigned in a 2-to-1 ratio to receive pulsed field ablation, PFA, performed with a pentaspline catheter, or to receive antiarrhythmic drug therapy. All study participants received an implantable arrhythmia monitor. Among these patients, the risk of recurrence of atrial arrhythmia was significantly lower among those who received PFA as first-line treatment than among those who received antiarrhythmic drug therapy, with a similar risk of serious adverse events between the two groups. John Sapp from Dalhousie University, Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada, writes in an editorial that Wozni and co-investigators used an innovative endpoint in this trial. Instead of relying solely on a 30-second recurrence of atrial arrhythmia, they required that such 30-second episodes be symptomatic, and they included asymptomatic episodes only if they lasted for more than an hour. This approach was based on the observation that episodes lasting more than 1 hour have been associated with more healthcare use. This endpoint may more usefully estimate the clinical effects of arrhythmia suppression efforts. The trial extends previous evidence of the effectiveness advantage of ablation over antiarrhythmic drug treatment for the suppression of paroxysmal atrial fibrillation to patients with persistent atrial fibrillation. Further study and experience will establish whether the real-world procedural safety is high enough to make the effectiveness profile clinically attractive for most patients, and will determine the effect of PFA on other cardiovascular endpoints and survival. Hospital policy of tranexamic acid to reduce transfusion in major non-cardiac surgery, by Brett Houston from the University of Manitoba, Winnipeg, Canada, and co-authors. Perioperative bleeding is a leading indication for red cell transfusion among hospitalized patients. The supply of blood components is increasingly constrained owing to rising demand and declining donor pools, which underscores the need for strategies that reduce the demand for transfusion. Tranexamic acid is an inexpensive and widely available antifibrinolytic medication that reduces blood loss and the incidence of red cell transfusion in cardiac and orthopedic surgeries. This trial involved 8,273 patients undergoing non-cardiac surgery who were at high risk for red cell transfusion. 10 Canadian hospitals were randomly assigned at 4-week intervals to a hospital-wide policy of intraoperative tranexamic acid, or placebo. Among these patients undergoing major non-cardiac surgery, a hospital policy of tranexamic acid administration resulted in a lower incidence of red cell transfusion than placebo administration, and tranexamic acid was non-inferior to placebo with regard to diagnosis of venous thromboembolism. Michael Murphy from the NHS Blood and Transplant, Oxford, and Ian Roberts from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, United Kingdom, write in an editorial that every year, many millions of surgical patients worldwide are unnecessarily exposed to a higher than necessary risk of blood transfusion because they do not receive a single dose of tranexamic acid just before the surgery. This failing is not due to a lack of high-quality scientific evidence on the overall safety, efficacy, or cost-effectiveness of tranexamic acid, but to poor implementation into clinical practice and lingering concerns regarding whether previous studies had ruled out the risk of thrombosis with sufficient confidence. The further evidence of the safety and effectiveness of tranexamic acid in surgery provided in the trial by Houston and co-authors should encourage its more widespread use. It may also stimulate consideration of following the lead of the United Kingdom in extending the use of tranexamic acid to surgeries even with a low likelihood of major blood loss or red cell transfusion. Effective strategies to increase the use of tranexamic acid in surgery in low and middle income countries where blood stocks are lower and transfusion risks are higher are urgently needed. The strong evidence that tranexamic acid improves surgical safety supports its inclusion in the World Health Organization Safe Surgical Checklist. A pragmatic trial of a 6-month strategy for rifampin-resistant tuberculosis by Francesca Conradi from the University of the Witwatersrand, Kiberke, South Africa, and co-authors. This Phase 3 trial conducted in South Africa assessed a 6-month treatment strategy for pulmonary rifampicin-resistant tuberculosis. 403 participants with pulmonary rifampicin-resistant tuberculosis who were 6 years of age or older were randomly assigned to a regimen consisting of bedaquiline, linezolid, dalamenid, and levofloxacin or clofazimine, or both, for 6 months, trial strategy group, or the 9-month standard of care treatment regimen that was current in South Africa, control group. Persons who were pregnant or breastfeeding and those who had fluoroquinolone-resistant tuberculosis were included in the trial population. The 6-month trial strategy was non-inferior to the standard of care strategy with respect to a successful outcome defined as cure or completion of treatment. The safety profiles of the two strategies were similar. 10-year outcomes after CAR T-cell therapy for B-cell lymphomas by Marco Ruella from the University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, and co-authors. Anti-CD19 chimeric antigen receptor, CAR T-cell therapy, is now a standard treatment for relapsed or refractory B-cell non-Hodgkin lymphomas. However, long-term results and curative potential remain uncertain. These investigators report the 10-year follow-up of 38 patients with refractory or multiply relapsed B-cell non-Hodgkin lymphoma who had been treated with CD19-directed CAR T-cells, now called tisagenlecleucel, in a Phase 2 clinical trial, providing a decade-long evaluation of efficacy, toxic effects, immune reconstitution, and survival. A single infusion of tisagenlecleucel led to decade-long remissions, lymphoma-free survival, in approximately 1/3 of the patients with large B-cell lymphomas and in nearly 1/2 of those with follicular lymphoma.
What happens when race is critical to diagnosis? The pulse oximeter is a device that's used in hospitals every day to measure a patient's oxygen levels. But are people dying because it gives faulty readings on darker skin?
The pulse oximeter did not back up how sick I was. And I knew I'd end up either coming back in an ambulance or worse.
It was devastating. How could I have missed this?
Maybe I could have done something differently because of someone's skin color. That's a hard thing to admit.
To hear all episodes of The Race Equation from the New England Journal of Medicine, subscribe to Intention to Treat.
Prevention and Treatment of Peanut Allergy, a clinical practice article by George Dutoit and Gideon Lack from King's College, London. Early introduction of peanut protein between 4 and 6 months of age reduces allergy prevalence by approximately 80% among infants at high risk for allergy, with efficacy diminishing as introduction is delayed beyond this critical window. Appropriate prevention involves ingestion of approximately 2 grams of peanut protein weekly for infants at low risk and 4 to 6 grams weekly for infants at high risk. Population-level implementation that targets all infants achieves greater reduction in disease burden than approaches that target only high-risk groups, although disparities exist among some ethnic groups and groups with restricted access to care. Peanut immunotherapy, initiated in younger children, 1 to 3 years of age, shows superior efficacy and higher rates of clinical remission as compared with immunotherapy initiated in older children. The natural history of untreated peanut allergy follows a trajectory of increasing peanut-specific IgE levels and clinical reactivity over time, underscoring the importance of early intervention during this narrow developmental window. A 53-year-old man with leg weakness, pain, and weight loss. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Rabigaha and colleagues. A 53-year-old man presented with progressive leg pain, weakness, and profound weight loss in the months after receiving a diagnosis of diabetes. 5 months earlier, the patient reported hip pain that radiated to the thigh. A month later, the patient had difficulty climbing stairs. He began using a cane for ambulation, then a walker. The patient sustained a fall while trying to stand up from his bed. He reported worsening weakness. Despite treatment for diabetes, he lost nearly 30 kilograms, developed muscle wasting in his thighs, and became unable to climb stairs except by pushing himself upward while seated. Extensive imaging and laboratory testing failed to reveal a structural, inflammatory, or malignant cause for his symptoms. Neurologic examination showed marked proximal leg weakness, absent reflexes, sensory loss in the toes, and thigh muscle atrophy. Electromyography and nerve conduction studies established the diagnosis of diabetic lumbosacral radiculoplexus neuropathy, also known as diabetic amyotrophy, a rare complication of diabetes that causes painful progressive weakness and weight loss. He underwent rehabilitation and treatment for neuropathic pain and was eventually able to walk independently with a walker. Access to GLP-1s for Medicare beneficiaries, A Bridge to Nowhere? A Perspective by Stacy Doucette-Zina from Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, Nashville. Medicare beneficiaries' access to GLP-1 drugs is poised to change in the coming weeks. In July, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, will launch the new Medicare GLP-1 Bridge Program, offering Medicare Part D enrollees an opportunity to obtain GLP-1 medications at $50 per fill to be used for weight loss or weight maintenance. The program will be available to virtually all Medicare Part D enrollees from July 1, 2026 through the end of 2027. GLP-1 Bridge will operate fully outside Medicare Part D, though participation will be limited to Part D enrollees. Clinicians who wish to prescribe GLP-1 drugs for a bridge-covered indication will submit a prior authorization request to CMS's central processor. Once a request is approved, the patient will obtain the medication from a chosen pharmacy with a $50 copayment. Patients will not use their Part D prescription drug insurance for these fills, and the $50 copayment will not count toward their insurance deductibles or their out-of-pocket limit for Part D. Pharmacies will submit these claims to CMS through a central processor and will be reimbursed at the drug's wholesale acquisition cost minus the $50 copayment plus a dispensing fee. Access to GLP-1s for weight loss and weight management under Bridge is temporary and does not include access to the manufacturer-funded lifestyle support programs that were expected to be available under the Better Approaches to Lifestyle and Nutrition for Comprehensive Health, Balance model. But Balance has been postponed. When health costs no longer count. Air Pollution and EPA Rulemaking, A Perspective by Ariane Teherani from the University of California, San Francisco, and co-authors. For decades, federal air pollution regulations have relied on cost-benefit analysis, which involves assigning monetary value to the illnesses, premature deaths, and other public health harms that are avoided because of a particular policy. In January 2026, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, published a final rule reflecting its decision to stop considering the monetary value of public health benefits in rulemaking related to air pollution. This decision is expected to have profound consequences for human health. Air pollution is one of the most studied environmental hazards. Its health effects are well documented. Poor air quality is associated with reduced life expectancy, increased rates of illness, including acute respiratory distress, heart attack, and stroke, elevated rates of emergency department visits and hospitalizations, and reduced lung function. For more than 40 years, the EPA has relied on cost-benefit analyses to evaluate environmental hazards and their health effects. By translating complex scientific evidence and technical data into dollar amounts, cost-benefit analysis can clarify the real-world consequences of policy options. Not accounting for the health-related harms of pollution doesn't make those harms any less real. Ignoring the costs of the health effects of air pollution deprives decision makers of information that is essential to understanding the risks and benefits associated with regulation and will cost lives. Improving global air quality indices, the WHO's new roadmap, a perspective by Robert Brook from Wayne State University, Detroit, and Sanjay Rajagopalan from Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine, Cleveland. Long-term elevations in PM2.5 and ozone account for most of the global disease burden attributable to air pollution. Nonetheless, tens of thousands of deaths per year in the United States and millions worldwide are attributable to short-term exposures, that is, those lasting a few days or less. To inform the public and help protect people during short-term increases in air pollution, many countries issue daily values from local air quality indices, AQIs. Since 1999, the United States has released such values with accompanying activity guidance based on pollution severity and individual susceptibility to pollution-related health problems to help people reduce harmful exposures. AQIs influence the daily lives of billions of people, affecting school, workplace, and travel policies, for example. Their use, therefore, has profound societal and economic implications. At a time when regulatory protections have increasingly become subject to political maneuvering and the burden of safeguarding public health is shifting to clinicians, local health officials, and the public itself, AQIs are taking on a more important role. To maintain public trust, such indices must be subject to robust, independent examination to ensure that they align with the latest scientific evidence. In a recent report, the WHO is calling for a transition from conventional air quality indices to health-based multi-pollutant indices that better communicate actual health risks from air pollution. The WHO report provides a framework for making these indices more health-based, equitable, and actionable. The before and the after. A perspective by Catherine Taylor from San Francisco Department of Public Health. There's the stigma of homelessness, and then there is the stigma of looking homeless. The street imposes itself on the body. It bends the spine, unsteadies the gait, leaves it shuffling, antalgic, slow. Waterlogged legs, burnt skin, track marks, skin-popping scars. When addiction and self-neglect collide, it is the skin that takes the worst beating. Every so often, a homeless patient of Dr. Taylor will share a picture of the before. With a head full of hair and a mouthful of teeth, the person is smiling from a photo that could be on any living room mantelpiece, glued into any family photo album. In showing the before, the patients are making explicit their assumption and acknowledgement of Dr. Taylor's bias. Or you could call it societal bias. Or you could call it the bias of a non-homeless person looking at a homeless one. There's a frankness in conceding the chasm between their lives. In part, Dr. Taylor thinks, it is a bid to be treated fairly. Dr. Taylor worries that this focus on the photo becomes a denial of sorts. As her patient pulls out the picture again, Dr. Taylor is desperate to get back to the urgent tasks at hand: heart failure meds, anticoagulation, substance use treatments. But also, maybe this is what gets him back, any of them back. Maybe the compulsion allows him to suppose a way forward. Maybe it is both intense self-denial and incredible self-belief that gets him to the after. Occasionally, and it is very occasionally, patients will come through, clothes washed, hair trimmed, eyes shining. They have stutter-stepped, stumbled, and lurched into recovery, stable housing, employment. And they look so good now, so impossibly, unbelievably, astonishingly well, that Dr. Taylor truly wants to take a picture and then cup it in her hands and show it to anyone who will turn her way. In our Images in Clinical Medicine, a 5-month-old full-term boy was brought to the clinic with a 3-week history of rash. The baby was irritable, with sparse hair, pitting edema of the limbs, and desquamation of hyperpigmented patches on the limbs and trunk. A diagnosis of kwashiorkor, also known as edematous malnutrition, or severe acute malnutrition with pitting edema of the arms and legs, was made. The typical dermatosis, as seen in this baby, resembles flaking paint. In another image, a 47-year-old man with heart failure and a reduced ejection fraction and an ICD for the primary prevention of sudden cardiac death presented to the emergency department with a first-time episode of syncope. During the event, which had been captured by video surveillance at work, he had suddenly collapsed backward without prodromal symptoms and had had a myoclonic jerk. See the video at nejm.org. A few seconds later, he had regained consciousness. Interrogation of the ICD identified an arrhythmia that progressed to ventricular fibrillation, after which a shock was delivered and spontaneous electrical activity returned. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.